Today is September 21st, 2010, and this is Adam Groves from the Illinois Fire Service Institute talking to Tom Rote from the Springfield Fire Department. We are discussing Joseph Rotherham, who died in the line of duty in 2003. Can you please tell me about the history of the Springfield Fire Department?
Well, I mean, ironically, some of the good history I've heard is from you. I mean, from the articles that you've shown me, from newspaper articles, that 14 line of duty death. I know I'm a huge buff on where the fire stations are, and I love driving around town and finding out the stuff. And one of the older guys that would just passed away, Dick Hall, was talking to me about where old number one firehouse was. Well, old number one firehouse to him is three houses removed from what I consider to be, you know, old number one. And Dick had just passed away, but unfortunately, as far as the history, I can't recount anything right off the top. I mean, of my head, as far as the history of the Springfield Fire Department, other than just the old pictures that I've seen, and knowing that it's all I'm doing is carrying on the legacy of was started long before me.
Can you talk about your career in the fire department?
I'm a 17-year, been on the job 17 years, joined February of 94 on Engine 1 downtown shift. Black shift, and I've been a captain of, I want to say, almost 5 years. Let's see. With the department, I was union president from 2003. Ironically, the evening before Joe passed away, I got sworn in as union president, and I stepped down as I didn't run again. I didn't step down. I finished my term, my second term, so I was 4 years as union president with Springfield Local 37. Prior to that, I was secretary treasurer for 4 years, and prior to that, trustee for several years. And currently, I'm secretary treasurer of the Associated Firefighters of Illinois, if that has any bearing on anything, which is the statewide organization based out of Springfield that handles legislation, collective bargaining, all kinds of issues for all 206 union locals in the state of Illinois. But I'm currently assigned to Engine 1. I've been assigned to Engine 6 for probably four of the years. I was assigned at Engine 5 as firefighter, and then as a, and again as a senior firefighter, and then again as captain for approximately 3 years, and signed number 3 as my first in-house company in 94. Absolutely hated it. It's quiet, too dead. Call every third shift. It's unbelievable. It's obviously picked up out there, but it's not a bad house to be at now. But I'm basically been assigned at number one firehouse downtown most of my career.
What was the department like at the time of Joseph Rotherham's line of duty death in 2003?
Ironically, not much different than probably it is right now. I mean, obviously the guys don't seem to change. Faces may change, but the members don't. I mean, the brothers don't, and firefighters don't really change much. We were having some trouble with some older rigs in 2003. I remember some of the apparatus that we had, it was some funding issues and some, it was just managerial type stuff. And obviously the fleet, I guess, was a little bit older than what it is right now. We enjoy some really nice rigs, thanks largely to Chief John Kulik that we've got, right? I mean, that just retired last year. We had 12 engine companies, 3 truck companies, 2 battalion cars, just like we do now. So there really wasn't much difference in the department layout. Responses were pretty much the same. We were districted the same way as we are right now. There's really not much change in the department since then.
What can you tell me about Captain Rotherham and his career?
Joe and I were stationed together. The first time we got stationed together was shortly after I moved out of number 3 firehouse, my first year on the job in 95. '95, I moved over to, we didn't have job bidding at the time, which basically meant the only way you could get out of an engine house and move to another engine house was to know somebody and or get lucky. And I just happened to get lucky because a firefighter at the time, Chad Rentz, who is now a captain as well at number 9, Chad Rentz actually had been assigned at number 5 and was ready to move out and get out of number 5. And so he had called me up, he knew that I wanted to leave, and he'd said, hey, I'm getting ready to, he was getting transferred, and since he was getting transferred, he was going to open a spot. So I met Joe for the first time. I was the junior firefighter, he's a senior firefighter at number 5 engine house. We stayed together, I think, I want to say almost 2.5 years. And so I worked with Joe for that period of time, and got to know him very well and got to know who he was. I mean, I was still pretty young and new to the job and still excited. And don't get me wrong, I'm still excited now, but I mean, I just had a different perspective on things. And especially with my background coming from kind of a small town, Pike County, graduating class, 28 people, Berry High School. I mean, coming into Springfield community like this, and especially being stationed on the east side of town, is quite an eye opener. And Joe was integral, he was tremendous in helping keep perspective on the job. So, but that's when I met Joe. Now, from that point, I left there. We ended up getting job bidding. Once we got job bidding, I moved downtown to number one firehouse, and Joe stayed. No, Joe didn't. Joe moved to another house. I don't remember which one it was. We ended up hooking back up again when I was a senior firefighter at number six, and he had made driver, and we moved out to number six together. That was actually, I know that was 1999 because the group of 30 had got hired on, and I was forced out of my downtown spot. And so I moved out, and I look at it at the time, I was upset because they moved me out of that house, but now I look at it and see it as what it was, which was a blessing to be able to spend some more time with Joe and continue our friendship. But we had Bart Zabarak, Jay Fritchie, and Mark Ballinger, three guys that are currently on the job right now. Ironically, two of the three are captains as well. So good guys, every one of them. But so they, we went through that process, and it was Joe helped me through my a lot of different things. From my grandfather passed away during that time frame. He was tremendous support for that, and just a lot of memories, late night discussions, and that type of thing with Joe. And we spent probably, I want to say, I stayed there another two and a half years at six. And we went through the remodel of number six engine house, which they gutted it and completely cleaned it out. And so we went through that together. And that's basically my history with Joe. So Joe is a unique individual. I remember when I was first, I don't even remember what fire we were on. I have no idea, but I just remember being, and actually, ironically, I mentioned this, and as I stated, I'd not too long ago, I'd just read the newspaper article from when Joe had passed. I'd found it in some clippings. And during the time frame, I remember going on a fire. I think it was buffaloed out to maybe number one firehouse or something at the time, and we went on a fire, and five had already been there, and Joe was the senior firefighter at the time. I wasn't stationed there yet, but I was buffaloed from number three downtown, so I actually got to go to the east side and fight a fire. And we got there after the fact, and they had already torn out the ceiling. The fire was pretty much out, and when we got inside there, and it was all smoked up. And I remember the smoke clearing and looking up in the rafters and of the, because they'd torn all the ceiling down, and there's Joe up there in the, no air pack at the time, you know, and he'd had it on, but it was in the overhaul stage, so he wasn't wearing it at the time. It was kind of a graphic picture of what I pictured a firefighter would look like. He wasn't a massive man or any muscular man or anything like that, but I mean, he was just working. I mean, he was just filthy. And I thought, you know, it was kind of impressive to see. And that was my first memory of Joe. So, I mean, anything after that, we got all kinds of stories in the firehouses. I mean, from at number five, Joe and I were, he used to be on the treadmill. One day in particular, I was up front in the day room, and somebody knocked on the door. And it was a couple, a man and a woman. They were selling, allegedly, they were selling school supplies or stuff for the school, like cookie dough. I don't know what they were selling, but prescriptions to magazines. And I didn't want to be rude. I said, all right, hold on a second. I took the brochure back to Joe, and I said, you want any of this? Kind of jokingly, he said, absolutely. And he meant it. Well, we never saw him again. They took our money, they were gone. I'm getting irritated and upset and basically pissed off during the entire process. I mean, during the time frame, waiting for these people to come back, bring me my stuff. Joe just smiled, he knew it wasn't coming back. And I'm talking to him about it, and he said, you just need to relax, you know, because he did the right thing. I did the right thing. And Joe was a tremendous person when it came down to having faith in the individual and in the person. He trusted everybody. I mean, it was up to you. You know, it was up to you to how you were going to lead your life. And he pretty much had faith that everybody was going to do the right thing. You know, and don't get me wrong, he was no goof. He pretty much knew when he was getting screwed. You know, he knew it, but he still did it. And he said he did the right thing. And you know, it was a pretty good lesson, I guess, for me, you know, in my career and even as adult, you know, that, you know, he was right. He's absolutely right. You have faith in the human being. I mean, at number six, we checked plugs. He'd always turn the plugs. He always said that's his workout. He'd turn every plug. I loved it. Hell, I never had to turn a hydrant. It was great. I'd just basically get off and hand him a tool, and he'd do it, and he'd turn every plug, and some of them were monsters over there, you know, to start them up. But at number six, when we were stationed together, we used to play Jeopardy every night. Final Jeopardy for a soda. I don't know that I ever bought him a soda. He won a lot of them. It was amazing how much worthless knowledge the guy was full of, but he was really sharp at all that stuff. Remember walking out into the rig room at night, 2 o'clock in the morning, whatever. We were both night owls, up late at night, and even call or no call, he'd be sitting out in the rig room on the couch prior to the remodel, and have cigarette smoke, basically a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, and sitting there, his shirt hanging open, reading either his Bible, you know, in his sock feet. Reading either his Bible or reading some Western book. And let's see, Joe hated aluminum. He wouldn't eat or drink. He wouldn't drink out of an aluminum can, and he wouldn't eat out of an aluminum pan because he said it would give you Parkinson's. And he believed it. And you know, there may be some basis to that. I don't really know. You know, I'm sure, but he used to read a lot of libertarian type stuff. He was very much libertarian, and just great times. But he was sharp. I mean, he was extremely intelligent man. He did things that, I realize we're still on anecdotal stuff. I can tell you about the guy. He just was an amazing person, and he did stuff in his life that most people sit there and go, yeah, there's no way you could have done all that. And after you talk to his family and his brothers and one of his brothers since passed on and talked to his son, and he's got pictures. He did this stuff. I mean, from working on a oil derrick to, he built a cabin with using pipes and, up in the, I don't know whether it was the Rockies, where the hell he was, but actually was able to woo, I guess you say woo, his wife, Sandy. She's a wonderful woman too. All kinds of stories that just keeps, I think about him often, and sometimes some things trigger memories of him, and you just never realize how close you get to somebody, and when you're living with them like that, just how much they mean to you until they're gone. So Joe used to eat just about anything, I swear to God. Now, he used to make this stuff called kabuku tui, or kabuku or kabuk, I don't know what it was, but it was nasty looking. And I actually tried it one day. I'll never drink it again. He used to drink it because it was some of its healing powers, or not spiritual type stuff, just like a concoction that he had worked up that he'd read in some health magazine or something like that. So that's what he used to drink, this stuff, and it was interesting. He was a lot of fun. Never a dull moment. He was quick to listen to you on when you're having a bad day. He was also quick to kind of set you straight, but he never did it in never yelling at you or anything like that. It was just a perspective he would give you just by talking to you and just kind of, and he wasn't, like I said, I think he was 45 or 46 when he passed away in 2003, and here it is 2010, and I'm 45 years old. So, I mean, and he had a wealth of knowledge that a lot of people don't realize, and I think a lot of people that don't know him and didn't know him, didn't understand. But as far as his political beliefs, a lot of times something would pop up on TV and he'd say, you know, and he'd bring up some conspiracy theory and it was just hilarious. He wouldn't rant and rave about it, and you know, it just, he'd bring it up and he'd smile. And then some stuff he'd bring up, and I truly believe he believed a lot of that stuff, which in some cases, I'll tell you what, I'm not too sure he was too far off, but there's no arguing and all that stuff, unless you wanted to talk to him about it, and then he'd be glad to debate the topic. It was a lot of fun. But, yeah, that was Joe. So,
can you please describe the incident in which Captain Rotherham died in the line of duty?
Well, I wasn't there, but I mean, what I do know about the incident, Andy Sandhouse was my firefighter last year for some time, and Andy and I have talked about it, and just briefly. What Andy told me was that they rolled up on this house. It was like a two-story house. Andy had said that they had deployed the line, got the line inside. There was some pretty good smoke in the building and some heat, but they hadn't located the fire yet. He said that what seemed odd was Joe seemed somewhat agitated, and that's not Joe. Joe was calm, cool, collected. Joe was competent as well as confident in his skills as a firefighter. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I would have gone with him in any fire and anything. And he kept his head, and Andy said that Joe seemed agitated and wound up, and it was just unusual. And especially when, they're not finding any fire or anything. And Joe sucked his bottle down. He said he went through his bottle real quick, and which was extremely unusual again. They exited the building together, and Joe, though, took his pack completely off, which he never did. He always basically left his pack on like most of us do. After the first bottle, you leave it on, you slide a new bottle in, and then you go back in, and or you take a break with it on because it's a big pain to put the thing on sometimes, especially when you're wet and tired in the first place. You don't want to take it off. You just find a position of comfort. And he said that Joe had basically told him, he said, just go on back in. I'll be right behind you. Bill Gilman was the safety officer on duty that day. I'm not too sure who the battalion chief was that day. But Gilman was the safety officer, and Bill had seen Joe sitting over on the front of the rig, and Bill and Joe were good friends, really good friends. Bill walked over to him and asked him, he said, okay, and Joe gave him the old, yeah, I'm fine, I'm just catching my breath, that type of thing. And he said, Bill still, I think it bothered him, it did bother him, because he felt like he could have maybe done something if he'd recognized or forced the issue, but there wasn't nothing he could have done about it. Bill walked away. Said shortly after he walked away, Joe spilled over and just went face first right in the street. And ALS was just a half block down. They were watching. They were one of those nights where they heard the call. They came in, so they're half block away, and they saw him go down. And they were on him. And they stripped his shirt open, pads on him, stripped him down, got him clean, padded him up, and he was systole, I guess, right out of the gate, no rim whatsoever, and they did what they could. But it was at the corner of 4th and Stanford. I'm pretty sure it was Stanford. That street's closed off now. It was with the Stanford overpass. I'm not sure whether it was closed off in 2003 or not, but the house is no longer there. It's an empty lot, and I drive by there once in a while and think about it. But right there in the street. But I know we had critical incident stress debriefing after the fact, and that's basically what I know, and obviously since I wasn't there, I mean I don't know how factual it is, but that's the stories and the what I tried to gather as a friend and what I tried to gather as a at that time the union president, what I knew to be factual. So okay.
You briefly mentioned the critical incident stress. Can you tell me some more about how the line of duty death affected individuals within the department or within the community as a whole?
Yeah, the community turned out. I was pretty impressed with the turnout for Joe's line of duty death. I mean, for the funeral anyhow, and it was pretty impressive. And the number of firefighters that came from throughout the state, and I was reviewing that article and looked at the number of guys that showed up. I was, wow, it's pretty impressive. But as far as the effect on the department, because I know I sat in on the critical incident of stress, and Molly Burns, who's one of our dispatchers, had been very close friends with Joe as well, and she's still working today, and she's got a birthday coming up Sunday, matter of fact. She was there, Bill Gilman was there, myself, Andy Sandhouse, a few other guys that had actually, that knew Joe, and were extremely affected. And I think the department actually did a good job on the critical incident stress. I mean, they had him in there, and it was, as much as I'm not a big fan of somebody telling me how I feel, how I should feel or anything like that, I think talking to everybody about it and talking about Joe and listening to the stories of what had happened that night and how things had, I think it was good. It was really good for, I think, everybody to get that out and talk. But it was it affected everybody differently. I mean, I can remember breaking down and talking about Joe and my experience that night after the fact, and going to Sandy, his widow, and pick her up and bring her to the hospital. So, yeah. So,
Can you tell me how Captain Rotherham was memorialized? Can you talk about the funeral?
Sure. My strongest memories are mostly not so much the procession, as I think it was kind of numb, just really sucked. You know, walking in there, and I just remember a lot of people lying in the streets and a lot of guys behind us. We walked next to the cast, next to the family, next to the limo. And then got to the armory. I just remember a lot of guys, a lot of blue, a lot of uniforms, you know, from throughout the state. And I think I was cold. I remember sitting in there. I was sitting right next to Dave Foreman, who at the time was the state president for the Associated Firefighters, and is a very good friend of mine. And I remember shaking. I was just shaking really bad. And nobody else seemed to be having that problem. But I think it was a lot of nerves and a lot of everything, emotions and everything going on with me. And having that place full and knowing that I was going to get up there and talk to, that was a little nerve-wracking. You know, and maybe that had something to do with it. But I just remember remember being physically cold. And walked up, and I walked past Joe's casket and gave my eulogy and paper. I had my things written out on a piece of paper. I was just kind of going at it and took my hands off the podium, and paper fell on the floor. And, you know, I think I remember making some kind of comment that it was Joe messing with me. You know, he loved to joke around. And but Sandy, his wife, and Jeff were sitting in the front row, and I remember looking down at them, and they were just as, I wouldn't say stoic, and I wouldn't say stone-faced. They were just calm. And it was, and I got to admit that seeing their strength through the whole thing helped me through the whole thing as well, because it was tough. I mean, just talking about him and everything else, just trying to just speak. And but they did a great job. I mean, they were fantastic. And then I asked them afterwards, I said, what the hell? I mean, how can you do that? And they said that was Joe's wish. He said, if anything, everything like that, you know, they weren't to cry, they weren't to be upset, they weren't to be anything. It was, he lived his life, and that's it. But as far as the, I mean, I guess if you want to go back to, that was basically the ceremony. And, but going back to the night it all happened, if you want, go even past when he was pronounced dead. Do you want to into that, or is there more questions coming up that'll lead into that? Because kind of,
I guess if you wanted to share something now.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I got the phone call at 3:00 in the morning. I'd been out with some guys celebrating because I'd just been elected union president, and actually had just been sworn in that night, the night before, and Joe died just a few hours later in the middle of the night. Seems like it was around 3:00 in the morning. I get the phone call. I was extremely upset. And drove down to number one firehouse captain, or now battalion chief, or at the time Captain Phil Harris came in. Phil was part of our honor guard, plus he was just a good guy. You could always count on Phil for everything, still can. And Phil and I drove out to Sandy's house, Sandy and Joe's house, and was it Greenview? Yeah, Greenview, north of town. And he was living out there restoring an old, restoring a house. And I just remember knocked on the door and looking through the window and seeing the lights came on. Sandy came down the steps and she saw my face and through the window, and just immediately just looked like somebody just kicked her right in the gut. And she came to the door and she goes, just ask me. And I told her Joe had had another heart attack, and Joe had had one prior and was able to get back to work, ironically. The doctors cleared him, the whole thing, but I said Joe had had another heart attack. He was in the hospital. She was asking me all kinds of questions as to whether or not Joe had, and since then I've had time with Sandy, and I've apologized to her for not telling her the truth. It's just I didn't want to talk. I didn't want to tell her. I didn't want to be the one, and it's like I wanted to give her that little bit of extra hope, you know, during that drive from Greenview to Springfield, that, you know, it was still there. I didn't know what the right thing to do at the time. I was nowhere near qualified to deal with anything like that. And but Sandy, Sandy had told me too, I do remember too her saying that if anything ever happened to him, that to call me. And ironically, I was the one that was the one calling on her when something did happen. We got her to the hospital. Once we got her to the hospital, I'd already been in the hospital before we went out there, and I knew Joe's passed. I mean, I knew he was gone. And then as soon as she walked in the door, Rich DeLee was another real good friend of Joe's that he was embraced Sandy. She knew at that point. And, yeah, Rich and Joe had a real good relationship, too. I mean, he thought the world of Joe. And then Sandy went in and spent her time with them. And that's pretty much, that's the night. Everything else from that point on was just trying to get our ducks in line for trying to regroup and figure out what we needed to do to take care of Sandy, make sure to take care of the benefits. You know, it's just we went into protecting his family as much as we could. So, but that pretty much, that's the night, and that's what happened that night.
Is there anything from this incident that you think would be helpful to today's firefighters?
I personally think physicals for the firefighters would be good. A lot of departments do have them, and they've been able to identify problems long before it becomes so catastrophic like this. But if anything to learn from it, I don't know. Joe, he had early signs, obviously, but everybody gets their days when they're peculiar and everything. It just so happened this one happened to be a catastrophic event where there's no turning back from this one. It's not a matter of he was having a reaction to some seafood or anything, and acting kind of funny or swollen up. This was something that happened that as much as Bill Gilman, the captain, the safety officer that was on duty that night, kicks himself, nothing he could have done. There was nothing anybody could have done. Joe, I think, may have even known that something like this may have been in his future. He may have known it was going to happen. But Joe was the kind of person that he was a firefighter. That's all he knew. That's all he wanted to do. He loved the job. If with this heart disease that he had, he would have just as easily died shoveling snow at home that winter, and that would have been a tremendous waste, in my personal opinion, because we would have missed out on a lot of who he was and what he was, what he did for the department, and what he did, the influence he had on people like me. So it was, I don't know whether it's the right thing to say or not, but I think it was apropos that he'd go this way, and I think he would have wanted it this way, period.
Is there anything else that you would like to share about Captain Rotherham or the Springfield Fire Department that we did not cover during this interview?
Oh, no, I am tremendously proud to be a firefighter and be on the Springfield Fire Department. I mean, it's a great job. It's a great bunch of guys to work with. I mean, I get frustrated with them. We all do, and crews and individuals and everything else. But Joe was one of the classiest guys that I've ever known in my life. And I think if I gained anything from that, it's just I always try to take the high road in my comments and my discussions and my thoughts. Not easy to do, and I can't say that I'm always successful, but a large part of that is watching how he reacted to people and listening to him and how he led his life. And tremendous memories and the debates and the discussions we'd have out at number 6 until the wee hours of the morning, until the point where either one of us either forgot what we were arguing about or completely changed sides. I mean, it was just, and it wasn't, and I say argue, but it wasn't argues. I mean, there were no arguments. There was always smiles and back and forth and debate. It was logical debate. Discussion back and forth, logical debate, based on what we knew to be factual. Tremendous family man, loved his family. I mean, he really, truly did. From his stepchildren to his blood children, and was very proud and spoke a lot about his son Jeff and when he was going through Navy SEAL training and ended up being EOD speaking and having phone calls that he'd have with Jeff, and very, very proud of what he did, and loved his wife Sandy. and oftentimes think back to Joe and his perspective on stuff. And it's just do the right thing, treat people right. It wasn't just the golden rule, it was above and beyond that. He didn't just treat people the way he expected to be treated, he treated them better. And that is absolutely no shit. That's the kind of person Joe Rotherham was. You know, hell of a guy.